I'm going to read out of Colossians chapter 1, starting in verse 15, verse 15 to 20. It won't be up on the screen, so just listen. And when I'm at the end of the message, we're going to read it together. So the first time, just listen. Listen reflectively. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him, and he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his Christ. This is one of Paul's great poems. It was written to a church in what is now Turkey, in a city called Colossae. And Paul didn't plant the church there, but a friend of his named Epaphras planted a church. He was from there. And he told Paul about the church. And Paul is praying for them to have wisdom to live a life pleasing to God. And in particular, he wants to develop and encourage their practice of giving thanks. A key component of wise living is being thankful, nurturing gratitude. And so he gives them this poem to help them in their practice of thanksgiving. So if you were to look for reasons to give thanks in the midst of the pandemic, what do you think you would find on social media and news stories and editorials? You'd find things like the curve is flattening here. But then you also find out, well, yeah, but thousands are dead. Families are bonding. Those good news stories, yeah, but some families are disintegrating. Gas prices are way down. Yeah, but so are jobs and incomes. And so with all the normal reasons for giving thanks, there's often, maybe always, another side to the story. Because what we look to in order to be thankful or to feel thankful are often contingent things, things that depend on this or that becoming true or staying true. And what Paul gives the little church in Turkey as the focus of their mental practice of thanksgiving is the fixed reality of who Jesus is and what he's done. Things that won't change, and yet this is the very thing, the gospel, that will change everything else. So it's important to back up and understand a little bit about Paul, his life and his circumstances, in order to understand why he would write a poem like this to encourage their practice of thanksgiving. We tend to read Paul's letters, or at least I have in the past, as if they were written from a seminary library, or maybe from a Starbucks as he's sipping coffee, cranking out theology emails, or posting thoughts on his apostles' blog. But Paul spent most of his waking hours doing hard physical work. That is, when he wasn't traveling in difficult circumstances, recovering from terrible injuries, or languishing in prison. Paul's a man who'd been in prison a lot, multiple times. He'd been tortured multiple times. He'd been rejected by the people he'd given his life away for. So what do you think all of this does to a person? This is a real person. He wasn't a machine. Well, it changes them. Sometimes it ruins people. It didn't ruin Paul. But we have to read his letters as those who have been written by a man who lived in extraordinary difficulties and who had learned in ways that few people ever have of the sufficiency of Christ. And so he knew personally what it took to be thankful always, especially when those that always included terrible circumstances. And so let's jump to a letter, one of his letters, 2 Corinthians. He's addressing the criticism of a church that was rejecting him in favor of more polished and successful spiritual leaders. He just wasn't cool in Corinth. In a prosperous Roman colony like Corinth, officials and people of importance were expected to celebrate their own achievements, much like today. Often, they would even have their list of achievements carved in stone and put in a public space. In fact, at one point, the Corinthians wanted fresh letters of recommendation for Paul because he just wasn't impressive enough for them. And so he gives them his own CV, his curriculum vitae, his course of life, his resume, but it's a strange resume. In place of real impressive accomplishments, we get this. He goes, okay, here, I'll give you my resume. I've been in prison more frequently, been flogged more severely, been exposed to death again and again. Five times I received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus one, which often you wouldn't survive. Three times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. Three times shipwrecked. I spent a day and night in the open sea. I've been constantly on the move. I've been in danger from rivers, bandits, my own countrymen, Gentiles, danger in the city, danger in the country, danger at sea, danger from false brothers. I've labored and toiled and have often gone without sleep. I've known hunger and thirst and have gone without food. I've been cold and naked. Besides everything else, I face the daily pressure of the churches. So Paul was writing this as irony. They wanted impressive resumes. He gave them this. You might say, well, that's impressive. Look at what he did for the gospel. But that's not reading it in his context. Think about it like this. Here's how you should read this. You're looking for someone to hire, and you get a resume. And here's a resume. I've been in prison a lot. I've been punished by authorities a lot. Been on the move. I just can't seem to stay in one place. I've been homeless a lot. No one likes me. I don't eat that much, don't sleep that much. I'm in turmoil on the inside a lot. You going to hire them? Sounds like an impressive person to you? That's how to read this. Now, before I read the next few verses, let me give you a bit of a backstory. For Roman soldiers, there was the equivalent of the Congressional Medal of Honor, our nation's highest military honor. And it was called, in English, it was called the Wall Crown. It was like the Medal of Honor. And it was given to the first soldier to get over a city wall on a ladder in a siege. Now, think about that. You've seen the movies. What could possibly go wrong if you're the first guy up a ladder on a wall when everybody inside the city is trying to kill you? As you can imagine, not many people live to claim the prize. This is the kind of heroic figure the Corinthians were looking for to be their representative in their celebrity culture. They're thinking, look, we could reach more Corinthians if we had a cooler apostle. Maybe Apollos. I mean, he's cool. He's a good speaker, better than you, Paul. And he's got a great name, Apollos. What a cool name. And so Paul gave them this. He said, I'm not the first up and first over the wall. I'm not the Medal of Honor. He said this in verse 30. If I'm going to boast, I'm going to boast of the things that show my weakness. In Damascus, the governor wanted to arrest me, but I was lowered in a basket from a window in the wall and slipped through his hands. So this is the opposite of this Medal of Honor, first over the wall. This was being lowered in a basket, a grown man lowered out a window to escape being captured and tortured. The Corinthians would have known that he was talking about what he was talking about. This was an unresume. So he did have some amazing experiences. He mentions one of them in chapter 12. He doesn't tell us much about it because he's not going along with the celebrity culture. Nowadays, there'd be 15 books and movies are written about what Paul saw. As a result of his amazing and largely undescribed experience, he has to go through some great difficulty, and he doesn't tell us what that is. He doesn't want it, though. I mean, who would? Listen to his conclusion. Three times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me, but he said, my grace is sufficient for you. My power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weakness, so Christ's power might rest on me. That's why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weakness and insults and hardships and persecutions and difficulties. For when I'm weak, then I'm strong. He wasn't crazy. He wasn't stupid. He wasn't a masochist. He didn't love pain. This was a choice he made. He loved seeing Christ's strength revealed, and that meant seeing his own weakness revealed. And so we get this great paradox, when I'm weak, then I'm strong. He wasn't confused. He had perfect clarity. That single line is really painful for me to even contemplate. You know, I hate the thought of what it means in practice. And so when you read things like 2 Corinthians 4:7, this is not a theological speech being tapped out on an iPad at Starbucks. This is his life. He says, we have this treasure in jars of clay. He's talking about himself, this broken jar of clay, to show this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. We're hard-pressed on every side, but we're not crushed. We're perplexed. We're persecuted, but not abandoned. We're struck down, but not destroyed. This is all real stuff from his life. So now we see why Paul gave a poem of Jesus in the gospel to encourage thanksgiving. How else could a person learn to be thankful in every circumstance unless they had a fixed point of reference for that thankfulness? And his fixed point of reference was the gospel. This year we're in Proverbs. We're looking at wisdom. This month we've been looking at Jesus, the wisdom of God revealed. And today we're focused on Paul's prayer for the church in Colossae, a prayer that leads to that great poem that we read to begin. So we focus on Paul's prayer because it gives us important clues for how to live a life of wisdom. And we could summarize his prayer like this. know God's will, and have the power to do it. So watch for two things to connect his prayer with Proverbs. We're going to read through the prayer, read through his exhortation, but Paul is praying that they would have wisdom and understanding, which is the goal of Proverbs. Wisdom is supreme. Proverbs says, therefore, get wisdom, though it cost you all you have, get understanding. So Paul's praying this very thing that Proverbs is about. And then he says he's praying that we would get wisdom and understanding with the purpose in order that we would walk in a manner worthy of the Lord. And wisdom is to walk a path. Proverbs is about the two-path life, folly or wisdom. And the ultimate wisdom is to walk in the way of Jesus. So let's read the prayer and discuss it as we go. He said, from the day we heard, this is starting in verse 9, heard of their faith from his friend Epaphras, we've not ceased to pray for you. And here's what he prayed. We ask that you may be filled with the knowledge of his will and all spiritual wisdom and understanding. In the secular, normal use, wisdom would have been mental excellence, like being an overall good thinker, and understanding would have been the ability to think through a subject clearly, like a good problem solver. But Paul adds an important qualifier to these human attributes. He adds the adjective spiritual to the quality of wisdom and knowledge. So by spiritual wisdom and understanding, Paul is describing something that can't be discovered by humans, but has been revealed by God. You can go out and fill yourself with all kinds of understanding about how the world works. You can just do that, Christian or non-Christian. But here, the fill is passive. God is doing the filling, and the things he's filling them up with is spiritual wisdom and understanding, meaning it doesn't originate in the human mind. It comes from God. And then there's a very specific purpose for this wisdom and understanding that he's praying for. Verse 10, he's praying it so that we would walk in a manner worthy of the Lord, pleasing him in every way, bearing fruit in every good work, and increasing in the knowledge of God. So notice the sequence. There's the prayer for wisdom. Then there's the purpose for gaining that wisdom, to live a life pleasing of the Lord. Then there's an outcome for that lifestyle, fruit and increased knowledge of God. So you've got this prayer for wisdom leading to life change, which brings more wisdom. It's not circular like a merry-go-round. It's more like a spiral staircase. It's know, do, grow, know, do, grow. My hand's probably all the way out of your screen. Know, do, grow, know, do, grow. This is a prayer for an increase in knowledge of what God wants for them, with the result that they would live as God wants them to live, leading to an increasing knowledge of what God wants for them and who God is. So information without application is a dead end. It is this merry-go-round, but information with application leads to transformation, this ongoing growth. And so when he writes that we would be fully pleasing to him, to Jesus, this is not an impossible ideal. I mean, who could live that way? This is about a settled life direction. This is walk with Jesus, mess up, fess up, move on. So how does all this happen? How do we turn this knowledge into action, into fruit and more knowledge? Look at verse 11. Being strengthened with all power according to his glorious might, for all endurance and patience with joy, giving thanks to the Father who's qualified you to share in the inheritance of the saints in light. So he asked that they would have wisdom to know the will and ways of God. Then he asked here for the power to do it. And his power is manifest in three important ways: endurance, patience, and joyful thanksgiving. Why these three? Think about those words. Because life is challenging, and it requires those three things to live well. These are the weapons, these are the abilities that we need to live in a world of crisis and pandemics. And when all this stuff goes away, all the other problems we're going to face. Circumstances are rarely going to be ideal. So how do we live dependent on God and not on circumstances to live our lives well? It's there in that phrase, power of God for endurance, patience, and thanksgiving. There's a little bit of a distinction between endurance and patience, because at first glance they seem like synonyms. What's the difference between endurance and patience? Well, endurance is faith, hope, and love applied to an apparently impossible or very difficult situation. Patience is faith, hope, and love applied to a difficult or impossible relationship. So endurance is situational, patience is personal. And they both have the same basis, faith, hope, love, flowing from the power of God. And so verse 11 helps us see that growth in the knowledge of God and a life lived to please him is going to be an uphill battle. We will only endure in this if we have God's power. And we will endure if we stay plugged into God's power. And then there is that joyfully giving thanks. God's strength empowers us to live in the world with endurance, patience, and thanksgiving. Does anyone need endurance for circumstances, patience with people, and thanksgiving in all of it? Raise your hand. Yeah, I see that hand and that hand and that hand. Yeah, there's hands in the sanctuary. So again, to live this way is a good definition of wisdom itself. It looks a whole lot like the life of Jesus, doesn't it? And in fact, Jesus is the reason for this joyful thanksgiving. Verse 13, this power for endurance and patience and thanksgiving is focused on He has delivered us from the domain of darkness and transferred us to the kingdom of His beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sin. And so thanksgiving is based on specific knowledge, a set of fixed facts, not feelings, not circumstances, but the facts of the gospel. So keep this all in mind. Endurance, this faith, hope, and love applied to difficult situations. Patience, faith, hope, love applied to difficult people or relationships. And joyful thanksgiving, practicing thanks in all of it. All three require God's strength. This is not merely try harder, do better. Now, by all means, try hard and do your best. What else would you do if you love someone other than try hard and do your best? If you love God, we're going to try hard. But this is not just about that. It's a life of the application of spiritual wisdom and power. So on the one hand, you can think about endurance and patience and joyful thanksgiving and say, I can't do that. It's beyond me. And you would be right. On the other hand, you would not be right, because you have access to God's power to live this way. And so back to Paul's great poem. He wrote this poem in the midst of the prose. Prose is normal speech. He's talking about power and endurance and praying. Then he moves into a more of a poetic style because he wants them to stop and think deeply. I told the kids they can choose the thoughts they allow to stay, and they can shoo away those breaky thought birds. Paul is consistently helping us to choose the thoughts that we let nest in our minds, because that's what shapes our lives. Now, God's going to love you. He's going to love me, even if we don't focus our minds, our thoughts, on things that will empower increased endurance, patience, and thanksgiving. But if we're still loved by God, but we're leaving a great benefit of the gift of our redemption on the floor, unpossessed, unused, if we don't take advantage of all that God's offering to us. We can't control all of our circumstances, but God is giving us the power, the opportunity to become more independent of our circumstances in our endurance, response to circumstances, our patience, response to others, and thanksgiving, experiencing joy in all of it. This is a gift. This is sort of a superpower side effect of the gospel. Why don't we take Him up on it? I'll tell you why. Because for us, like Paul, to experience God's power, we have to face our own great weakness. Paul said, therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weakness so that Christ's power would rest on me. This is wisdom, the humility to face and to embrace our weakness in order to reveal and experience Christ's power. Austin talked about that in his testimony. They're overseas partners, and he talked about his need for humility in order to experience wisdom. And I struggle with this. I can read the words, but the truth behind those words is really hard for me. I don't like weakness. I despise weakness in myself, and unfortunately, I despise weakness in other people. And what that does is makes me a fool. Pride makes us foolish. But the solution is not try harder to embrace your weakness, meditate consistently on your failures. The solution is not you should drive around, or you're not driving around, sitting around in your house, whatever you're doing, and meditate all day long on how messed up and weak you are. That's not where Paul goes. He acknowledges his limits, his weakness. Then he says, okay, now here's where I want you to go with your mind. Set your mind on Christ and the gospel. So when I'm weak, then I'm strong. And then he wrote this great poem, and the central focus was on Christ, not on human weakness. Now, our limitations should be obvious to us, but we have to become people who increasingly understand that when we are weak, then He is strong. And I think what you do is you glance at your weakness, but you have to set your gaze on Christ. So we're going to read this poem together. This will be our concluding prayer for today, and then we're going to sing it together. Then we're going to sing together. But what I'd like you to do is to, we're going to read it, but I'd like you to take some time and maybe mull over this this great passage together by yourself in your quiet times or wherever this week. I've done it this week. A couple of things before we read it, it'll be on the screen, is when it talks about him being the firstborn, it's talking about his preeminence. Christ is eternal. He's not been made. And when it talks about him being the firstborn from the dead, he was the first to be resurrected. And all who are in Christ will follow him. So let's read this together. It should be on the screen. Is it on the screen? Good to go? Okay, let's read this together. Follow me. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross.